This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. فلما دخلوا على يوسف آوى إليه أبويه وقال ادخلوا مصر إن شاء الله آمنين. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. فالحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. أما بعد, once again everyone, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته. Today I have a discussion planned for you that's revolving ayah number 99 of Surah Yusuf. I'll translate it first. It seems pretty straightforward at first glance, but there's a what seems like a slight, but I think it's a deep enough conversation necessary that this ayah should be discussed on its own. I would say to start off that in order to grasp what we can from this ayah and to share with you guys what we've come to learn and what can be of benefit for myself and all of you, trying to, you know, extract as much wisdom and guidance we can from the Quran. This was quite an exercise for both myself and Suhaib, and it was actually pretty rewarding. So I'm grateful that we have each other and that Allah Azza wa Jal has given us this opportunity to do this kind of tadabbur and this kind of reading and research. So let me first start off by translating. We're at the scene now where the parents have arrived in Egypt. So فَلَمَّا دَخَلُوا عَلَى يُوسُفَ, when they all came into, entered upon Yusuf, literally entered upon Yusuf would mean that perhaps it means they came into the court of Yusuf alayhi salam, and it's when they entered, that means all of the sons of Jacob, all of their families, the wives, the children, the Yaqub alayhi salam, and his wife also apparently, right? So this large family gathering has now come into the presence of the ruler of Egypt, which is Yusuf alayhi salam. There are narrations surrounding this moment about how there was a procession, thousands of soldiers, and how even Yaqub alayhi salam saw him and said, is that the Pharaoh? Because that wasn't a bad word at the time, right? Is that the Pharaoh? Or is that the Fir'aun of Egypt? And he was told, no, this is Yusuf alayhi salam. So, you know, in the course of all of that, there are other things that have been said in the narrations that I'm going to skip a little bit, but get to, you know, what we can, what we need to definitively discuss. So they came into the company of Yusuf. They entered upon him. First thing, awa ilayhi abawayhi. He pulled both of his parents towards himself. And the word pull towards yourself, awa ilayhi, is the same verb that was used for when he pulled Binyamin towards himself in order to protect him. It's the same verb that's used in the Quran to describe the young people who pulled themselves into the cave to protect themselves. Though the root letters Hamza, Waw, and Ya, and the Maslad is Awiyan, Al-Awi, and the If'al version is Iwa, this word actually means to stick to something because though if you go into a cave because you're too weak to withstand the cold or the winds or whatever else, then you've engaged in the act of Awi, meaning you stuck to something for protection. But it could be you cling to someone because you're sad, or a baby clings to the mother because it needs comfort. So every time the weak or the needy cling to someone for refuge, for comfort, for ease, then that's the verb that's used. And the verb used here suggests that Yusuf alayhi salam can't wait to be the comfort for his father. Like he can't wait for that moment where he gets to comfort him. So awa ilayhi abawayhi. But the challenge here is awa ilayhi abawayhi. He pulled both of his parents towards himself. He pulled them in to give them refuge, to make them feel safe, to give them comfort. All of that's included. But it doesn't just say that about Yaqub. It says it about both of his parents. And this is peculiar because so far in the story, mom hasn't been brought up at all except by passing reference when the dream was mentioned, right? Because the sun and the moon represent the mother and the father, right? So this is a curious thing. Mom has been absent throughout the story, and now she's being implicitly brought up again because abawayi, the pair form in the Arabic, is basically a combination of ab and right? So the mom and dad is included, and they're both his parents. And that's why I titled the talk today in this way. So the first thing that I'd like to maybe help you understand is why is mom missing in the story? Obviously, when you lose a child, then the tragedy of that and the devastation of that would hit both parents, and arguably even more so the mother. So one argument is that the mother had already passed, the actual, you know, biological mother of Yusuf alayhi salam had already passed away. But before we get into that conversation, let's look at the Quran's formula for telling stories. You see, you and I are used to hearing a story or hearing an event, and we want all perspectives. We want the full account. And it's fair to ask the question, because we have these sensibilities of how stories are told, how come the mom's not being talked about? But let me tell you something about the Quran's formula for telling stories. The Quran's agenda is actually not to tell a story, first and foremost. The Quran's agenda is to give us lessons, guidance, and principles that can be extracted from parts of the story Allah considers timeless, of timeless value, right? So He wants us to learn something from these events, but not every single detail of these events. These are a few decades in the making, the story of Yusuf alayhi salam. But we have a few pages, if not even volumes, we have a few pages capturing those decades. So what Allah did is He took bits and pieces from that story that we need for guidance. And everything else has been omitted, not because it's unimportant. It's important historically. Obviously, it happened to these same people. Every single day that transpired in the life of Yaqub alayhi salam has value. Every minute he spent, every prayer he made has value. But there are some things that Allah considered of timeless value that represent guidance for all human beings that will seek guidance from Allah until Judgment Day. Having said that, what Allah does in the Quran is that He compromises telling you about all the characters in a story or everything about any one character. He only focuses on the things that go towards that heart, that higher purpose. So it might come across to you, if I was personally telling you a story and I skipped out on the mom, you'd say, hey, well, what about the mom? But the Quran isn't doing that. The Quran is not interested in telling you a story. The Quran is interested in guiding you. لَقَدْ كَانَ فِي يُوسُفَ وَإِخْوَتِهِ آيَاتٌ لِلسَّائِلِينَ. And it's actually the same reason that in the story of Musa alayhi salam, the father is pretty much entirely absent. Even though he has a father, he's entirely absent from the story. And even if you don't think about the father and the mother, you know, there are elements like Harun alayhi salam was his younger sibling or older sibling, right? But he's missing from the story in the beginning too. And his sister has to go get him by the water. So there's other interesting questions. Allah skipped some details in the Quran because He wants our focus on other things, right? So that, having said all of that, and that is the formula of the Quran, really. Like in any, you'll notice in the storytelling in the Quran, more is missing than is said. That's actually the formula. So we have very little that's been said, but the little that's been said is so valuable and so powerful. And what's even more interesting is that when you compare the volumes, like exponentially larger text in the whatever transcript of the Bible we have now, the Hebrew Bible that we have now, that covers this same story, it's exponentially bigger in the Bible. It's huge in the Bible. And in the Quran, in the much more skimmed, arguably skimmed version, you shouldn't have the kind of detail that's in the Bible, but actually the Quran is talking about things the Bible didn't even touch. The Quran is addressing things that were never known even by the Israelites. They just weren't known. So this is a remarkable feature of the Quran. But regardless, now it's important to bring up that Allah decided not just to say that He pulled His father who was stricken with grief. He says He pulled both of His parents in, right? So that's going to require a little bit of a conversation. So, and at the end of all of that, I'm going to try to help you think through what could be the benefit in us hearing that from Allah. The both parents comment, because every word is of value, right? So it's a peculiar addition to the story, and it definitely deserves attention. So we're going to do a little bit of that, inshallah, or maybe a lot of bit of that, and then we're going to get to the rest of this ayah. So, and I won't even translate the rest of it yet, because that'll fit in once we have this discussion in place. So first, I'm going to walk you through a summary of what our scholarship, Muslim scholarship, has had to say about how they can fill that gap. What is it? What's the purpose, or who is being referred to by the mother? So I'll read some things from Fakhruddin al-Razi first. Al-Bahth al-Awwal fil Murad biqawlihi abawayhi qawlan. When it comes to both his parents, there are two views. There are two things that have been said. Al-Awwalu al-Murad abuhu wa ummuhu. The first meaning is, what is meant by this is his father and his biological mother. وعلى هذا القول فقيل, and based on this, what's been further substantiated is إن أمه كانت باقية حية إلى ذلك الوقت, that his mother was still alive up until that time. وقيل إنها كانت قد ماتت, and it's also been said that it she actually had already passed away. إلا أن الله تعالى أحياها, except that Allah brought her back to life, وأنشرها من قبرها, and pulled her out of her grave, حتى سجدت له تحقيقا لرؤية يوسف عليه السلام, so she can do the sajda, you know, to confirm the dream of Yusuf عليه السلام. So our mufassirun, because we came to hear from reliable Israelite sources that the mom had actually passed away, they said, well, Allah must have brought her back to life, right, in order to fulfill this dream, because it says both his parents, so that must mean her. And by the way, her name from the biblical version is Rachel. Okay, so we're going to use that name. Al-qawlu thani anna al-murada buhu wa khalatuhu. The second position has been, Muslim scholarship, that the meaning here is his mom, and, or his dad, and his mom's sister, his khala. Okay? لِأَنَّ أُمَّهُ مَاتَتْ فِي النِّفَاسِ بِأَخِيهِ بِنْ يَمِينَ. Because his mother died while giving birth to Bin Yamin. Benjamin, the younger brother. وَقِيلَ بِنْ يَمِينَ بِالْعِبْرَةِ. We can skip that part. وَلَمَّا مَاتَتْ أُمُّهُ تَزَوَّجَ أَبُوهُ بِخَالَتِهِ. And when the mother died, then the father married her sister. So that's the scholarship view, Muslim scholarship view on this, or the opinion that's been found. فَسَمَّهَ اللَّهُ تَعَالَى بِأَحَدِ الْأَبَوَيْنِ. So Allah named her one of the two parents because لِأَنَّ الرَّابَّ تُدْعَى أُمَّا لِقِيَامِهَا مَقَامِ الْأُمِّ. Because the one who nurtures or takes care, because when Rachel died, the one taking care of both kids was the sister in her place. So she was playing the role of the mother. And in Arabic, the role of the mother, whoever plays the role of a mother, is also called mom. And that's actually a contemporary thing too. When you're raised by somebody, even if they're not your biological mom, you're still going to call them mom, right? You just get accustomed to that, and that's a normal thing. أو لأن الخالة أم كما أن العب أم عم أب. Or it could be that the aunt in ancient language is actually considered a kind of mother, just like the uncle is considered a kind of father. And that's actually true in the Quran because وَإِلَهَ أَبَائِكَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ وَإِسْمَعِيلُ وَإِسْحَاقُ. Just to give you a little bit of timeline, because some of you aren't as familiar with this stuff or it's not settled in your head, so bear with me, okay? So Ibrahim alayhi salam has Ismail and Ishaq, right? Ishmael and Isaac. Isaac has Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, right? So Ibrahim, then Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, and then the 12 sons. Ibrahim, Ishaq, and then Yaqub alayhi salam, and then the 12 sons of Yaqub alayhi salam. Okay. When Yaqub was dying, he told his sons, what are you going to worship after I'm dead? And the Quran said, they responded, we will worship your God and the God of your fathers, Ibrahim and Ismail and Ishaq. So when they were talking about they're telling Jacob, your fathers, right? They didn't say your fathers, Ibrahim and Ishaq, because that would be father and grandfather, right? They included uncle in it. Because what is Ismail to Yaqub alayhi salam? He's his uncle. But they included what word? The God of your fathers, ilaha abaika, Ibrahim wa Ismail wa Ishaq. So what you find as a qarina, as an evidence in the Quran and also in language, is sometimes the uncles or the aunts were actually also referred to as father or mother. And this is actually what has also been claimed about Ibrahim alayhi salam's father, because the Arabic word used for him in the Quran is abihi, his father. And there's an interesting side conversation that Tabatabai mentions in his tafsir. And some of you will have an allergic reaction because I quoted Tabatabai, because it's not a Sunni source. I read Western literature. I'll read an atheist about the Quran. I will read Christian literature on the Quran. I will read anything I can on the Quran. If I find evidence or reason in it, or I want to hear what the other argument is, I will keep an open mind and study and read. So I have my own convictions in faith, but I don't discriminate when it comes to seeking information or seeking knowledge. You know, if we take that approach, then, for example, if I want to study linguistics or Arabic, then one of the most remarkable pinnacle works in tafsir studies is Al-Kashaf by Zamakhshari. Anybody who's worth anything in tafsir knows that. But he's known to be Mu'tazili, And I don't carry Mu'tazili views in terms of understanding theology. And that is a very, you know, obscure, you know, view of the Aqidah of Islam. And yet he's still the gold standard in grammatically analyzing and rhetorically analyzing the Quran. And so many after him who hated his guts for his views, his beliefs, actually took knowledge from him when it came to Arabic analysis, and in many cases even plagiarized him. So there's that. So I don't personally discriminate when it comes to looking at different sources and what has been said and how has it been, you know, argued and substantiated. The thing at the end is our loyalty is not to an author. Our loyalty is to the divine author. And anybody who makes an argument, we look at what is being said more than who is saying it, right? And which is exactly what a judge is supposed to do in court. Before they look at what statement, you know, who's making the statement, they have to look at what is the statement itself. They have to value the word itself, right? And that's what true research should be about. Anyway, so Tabatabai's discussion, and thank you, Suhaib, for bringing that to my attention. I'll give you the you know, basic version of it, is that Ibrahim alayhi salam, by the end of his life, he makes this dua in which he says, my master, forgive me, wali walidayya, and forgive both of my parents. Forgive me and forgive both of my parents. Even though there's an injunction in the Quran that he's not allowed to pray for his father. Okay, that cannot happen anymore. And that there's an istithna given in the Quran. So there seems to be this conflict. But actually it's resolved by Tabatabai in his view by use of the word ab and walid. That walid is the maternal biological or the biological father. And ab is actually the one who raised him, which is why so many professors said that Azar was actually his uncle who raised him. So there are two different things. Ab is the father figure. You can even call it the father figure. And sometimes the biological father is the father figure. Other times the biological parent has passed away or he's absent and the uncle is the father figure or somebody else becomes the father figure. They don't become the walid, but they can become the ab. They can be the ab. And this is the word that's being used in this ayah, abawayhi, right? So it's the one that plays that role is actually being highlighted in the word abawayhi. So that's what we got from the tafasir. There's a couple other comments here that I want to read to you. وَقِيلَ أَنَّهُ لَمَّا تَزَوَّجَهَا بَعْدَ أُمَّةٍ صَارَتْ رَابَّةً لِيُوسُفْ. And it's also been said that when he married her, that after some time, she became the caretaker for Yusuf alayhi salam. فَنَزَلَتْ مَنْزِلَةَ الْأُمْ. That she was given the status of a mother. لِكَوْنِهَا مِثْلَهَا فِي زَوْجِيَةِ الْأَبْ. Because she is in the place in being married to the father. وَقِيَامَهَا مَقَامَهَا وَالرَّابَّةِ تُدْعَى أُمَّنْ وَإِنْ لَمْ تَكُنْ خَالَةً. And the caretaker can be called a mother even if she wasn't the aunt. وَرُوِيَ عَنْ إِبْنِ عَبَّاسِ رَضِيَ اللَّهُ تَعَالَى عَنْهُمَا الْمُرَادْ أَبُوهُ وَجَدَّتُهُ. Ibn Abbas has been attributed to him that this means his father and his grandmother. وَأُمُّ meaning the mother of his mother. حَكَاهَا الزَّهْرَاوِي. So there are these different, you know, kind of views in Islamic literature. But in order to really grasp this better, I think we have to turn to the genealogy that's mentioned in the Bible and how things kind of played out. This is going to take a little patience from you guys, and I pray Allah gives me clarity in presenting this to you because I think it'll really help. And then inshallah, we'll tie it all together with what I think we can benefit from this ayah, okay? So if you can bring that screen up, Valerie, thanks. So I'm going to tell you a little crazy story. And those of you that watch like Pakistani dramas and stuff, you about to get a treat. So, there's a man named Laban, and Laban had his youngest daughter, her name is Rachel. He had a daughter older than that, Bilhah, and another one, Zilpah, and the last one, Leah. So he's got four daughters. Notice two of them are in gray because they're considered handmaidens. In other words, they were daughters from a servant or, you know, from a slave woman or a servant woman. So they're not given that full status. What happened in ancient society, apparently in ancient Hebrew society, is that when you had multiple children and some of them from a wife and some of them from a servant, then that was given to you, then the children of the servant become servants of your other children. So basically the red become the grays become the servant of the reds, according to this. Okay, so Zilpah and Bilhah are servants to Rachel and Leah. And the way it used to work is, if you have Rachel is younger and Leah is older, so the younger girl, the younger servant, will serve the younger daughter, the older servant will serve
the older daughter. Okay, that's just how things used to work. Now, it so happens that there's a young man named Jacob, Yaqub alayhi salam, who has a twin brother in the Bible. His name is Esau. Okay, E-S-A-U in English spelling. Okay, and he is basically what you can call an evil twin. He's older, so he came out first, and he is an idol worshiper. He is into adultery and fornication. He does all kinds of evil things, but they are twins. And it's so bad between them that at one point, Esau tries to kill Jacob. He tries to kill Yaqub alayhi salam. And Yaqub alayhi salam escapes and comes into this town. And it was, or when he's escaping, even before then, it was already known that Jacob and, you know, Yaqub alayhi salam and Esau, the two brothers, are going to get married one day. And the family that was primed to marry them was Laban's family. And the idea was the younger son will marry the younger daughter and the older son will marry the older daughter. So I'm giving you the broken down version of this genealogy from the Bible. And it's going to seem like it's a lot, but inshallah, it'll make sense why I'm telling you all of this in a couple of minutes. Okay, so the idea was since Yaqub is younger, he's supposed to marry Rachel. And since Esau is older, he's supposed to marry Leah. When Leah finds this out, that the word is that you're supposed to marry Esau, she's like, he's a thug, he's a gangster. She's crying all the time. And and she's so distraught and she's constantly praying to God to change her fate, okay? Because she doesn't want to end up getting married to this guy. It's like an Indian movie for some of you, okay? So she's just losing her mind because she doesn't want to marry him and she's praying that God changes her fate. Yaqub, again, the biblical version, Jacob comes to this family. He completely falls in love with Rachel. He wants to marry her. He asks for her hand in marriage. Laban, the father, agrees. And when you marry, then your servant comes with you, right? So Bilhah or Zilpah, whichever one's younger, will come with Rachel because the younger one with the younger daughter, remember? The younger servant with the younger daughter. Okay, so she'll keep her servant when she gets married. Laban plays a trick. He, you know, because they're veiled when they get married as customary clothing. So he wants his older daughter to get married first. So even though he says that you're marrying Rachel, he actually puts Leah in her place and Rachel stays quiet about it, even though she wants to marry Jacob and she's really happy about it. The father says, no, the older daughter has more right. She's going to marry him. Just don't tell him anything. We'll talk about it after it's done. And in order to complete the deception, even though Leah is older and her servant is supposed to be the older one of the two, Bilhah and Zilpah, he put the younger one of those two next to Leah, had her covered, and thus deceived Jacob, Yaqub alayhi salam, and they got married. And when it's unveiled, it's the one whose eyes are baggy from all that crying, and she's not the Bible would describe Rachel as pretty, and he really liked her, and he really wanted to marry her. And he comes to, and by the way, the mehar, the dowry was that you're going to work for me for 7 years. Right, so you can get married to her now, but to pay me off for marrying, the marriage gift is you're going to serve 7 years. He says, well, you know, yeah, I did that, but you know, older daughters should really get married first. And if you still want to marry Rachel, you can, by the way, in Islam, now that's haram. أَن تَجْمَعُوا بَيْنَ الْأُخْتَيْنِ إِلَّا مَا قَدْ سَلَفْ. The Quran talks about this, that you cannot marry two sisters except for what's already happened. But apparently pre-Torah, because this is not even the days of the Torah, this is the Jewish civilization before what we consider Judaism, because the Torah was revealed to Musa alayhi salam generations later. This is before the days of that, right? So this is from Abrahamic times, early times, right? So some of these rules and regulations aren't there. Anyway, so he says, well, you wanted to marry Rachel, I understand, but I really wanted my older daughter to get married first. That's why, you know, I duped you into getting this. Yeh shadi nahi ho sakti, but ab to ho gayi, right? It's done. So now when it's done, he's like, well, if you want to marry Rachel, you still can. Just add another 7 years to the deal. Work for me for 14 years and you can marry Rachel too. So basically it describes that in a matter of days or a very short period of time, Jacob got married again. So now he has two wives. He has Leah and Rachel, and the servant girls came with them to serve each of those wives, right? And this brought Leah great deals of depression because she felt like she's not the first choice. She's not the one he truly loves. She's prettier. She's younger. He likes her more. And then the Bible describes that God so made it that to compensate her for her sorrow, that Leah was the one who could have kids and Rachel couldn't have kids. For the longest time, Rachel could not have kids. So let me show you what happens next. So Leah, right? She has a son named Reuben. Then she has a son named Simeon. Then she has a son named Levi. Then she has a son named Judah, mashallah. So there's four boys. Four boys are born. And the idea is, there's also literature about how they were competing spiritually. They knew that they're married to a prophet and they're part of the noble legacy of Ibrahim alayhi salam. And they want as many sons with him as possible because that noble legacy will pass on and they have a share in that good deed. So that spiritual sort of legacy was a matter of pride back then for them. So Leah has four sons. Meanwhile, Rachel can't have any children. So she comes up with a plan. She tells her husband, Jacob, they're both married to him, right? She tells her husband, Jacob, why don't you take Bilhah? Meaning she's giving her hand off to her husband. You know, ma malakat imanukum, you can be with my servant girl. This was allowed back in the day. And so you can marry her and have children with her. And I will raise them as my own because she's my servant. So he does that. He's with her. And then they have two kids, Dan and Naphtali. Now, Leah finds, you know, when as this is happening, she's getting upset because she wasn't having kids in the middle. So she says, you know what? Take my servant girl and give me additional kids too. So now Yaqub alayhi salam, from the biblical version, has God and Asher. Now they've got eight kids. And after they have eight kids, Leah ends up having the ninth and the tenth and even a daughter. So Issachar, Zebulun, and Dinah, all these kids. So now, you know, what could go wrong? You've got four women. You've got three of them with multiple kids. There's no room for any possible jealousy of who's the favorite child or which one matters more or whatever. Obviously, it's all good in the hood, right? Everything's okay. But at the end of the day, if you think about it, the contest between Leah and Rachel, if you understand this contest, Leah felt like, what's the edge she has over Rachel? Well, he loves her, and she's clearly the younger one and the prettier one, but at least I gave him all the kids, right? And even if she gave him kids through the servant, well, I even the score there too. So I still maintain my advantage. At least the powers, you know, the there's no disturbance in the force, okay, so far. Then what happens is Rachel finally gets pregnant and has Yusuf. She gives birth to Joseph. And then sometime later, she dies giving birth to Benjamin. So the one thing that Leah had over Rachel, which was that she couldn't have kids, at least directly, and in every other way she was compensated for, now that advantage is gone. And what's the reminder of that? Yusuf and Benjamin. Now I want you to think about the psychology of this. If the sons are constantly seeing this, feeling this, you know, towards Yusuf and Benjamin because of this existing rivalry between Leah and Rachel, which hasn't been talked about in the Quran clearly, but the Bible does talk about them competing with each other. On the other side, Bilhah and her two sons were perfectly fine. They were all of these, by the way, from one all the way to 10, all of these 10 are basically okay with each other because, you know, everything's fine. But now even Bilhah's kids, Dan and Naphtali, are like, well, we thought we represented the Rachel side of the family, but now she has kids of her own. So they're becoming team the rest also, and the only ones isolated are Yusuf alayhi salam and Benjamin. Now, when you read the Quran and you read, Yusuf and his brother are more beloved to father than we are. So the woman that he loved all along has died, and the only remnant of her is Yusuf and Benjamin. You understand? Plus, not to mention their character, which is what the Quran's highlighting. The Quran didn't highlight he loves them more because of Rachel. The Quran highlights he loves Yusuf because of his character. So there's a different version of the story. Now, I gave you all of this background for a reason. To tell you that the Quran didn't say any of this. The Quran said none of this. None of it. Why not? Why in the world not? So let me talk about that first before we get to the both parents. This is still the both parents conversation, believe it or not. So you can take the screen away now. Here's the thing about why the Quran didn't bring all of this up. Once you understand this entire family dynamic, like watching a soap opera, you're like, oh, that's why they were jealous. Oh, that's why. No wonder he hated Yusuf. No wonder they hated Benjamin. Oh my God, their mom made them do that. It was like these aunties, man. Like you had all this, like you start coming up with an entire scenario of how this would work and how this plays out in families. What does the Quran do? The Quran makes all of that irrelevant to teach us something. That is, it is irrelevant. The situation, the drama, the tension, the rivalries, all of that is actually just a facade. The real thing is the devil. Shaitan creates jealousy. Shaitan creates the need to overcome or to look down upon someone else. Shaitan does all of that, not human beings. Not the human beings fall into the waswasa of shaitan. Allah did not endorse that. So what is the, who's the enemy in the Quran's depiction of this entire family drama? And none of this drama has been talked about in the Quran. What's the drama? Brothers hate brother. That's the tension that Quran describes. And what's the cause? The devil got to you. If you study the Bible, it's not the devil that got to them. It's this family dynamic that's the reason. You understand? So you've got this human psychological kind of reasoning. And the Quran says, no, you need to understand the underlying spiritual problem. The underlying spiritual problem is how the devil is able to manipulate your emotions. You see what a profound higher road the Quran has taken in describing this story? Right? It's a mind-blowing thing that the Quran has done here by not describing all of this. And when you study it, you're like, oh, now this gets even more interesting. Because Rachel dies while giving Benjamin birth, right? And then when she dies, according to the Torah and according to Jewish history, and I tend to have personally, I tend to have more confidence in Jewish genealogy more than anything else, because their genealogy really matters to them. So when they document who's the son of who and who's the all that stuff, that I have more confidence in. What the prophets said and did, I have less confidence. I take that with more of a grain of salt. But when it comes to their genealogy, because their identity as a people is so rooted in who's fathering who, who's the mother, where they come from, all that stuff, that's super important to them. So that I put some stock into, right? So now if you understand that, then you know that Yaqub alayhi salam theoretically now has four wives. One of them has died. Yes? One of them has died. And the others have sons that all hate who? Yusuf alayhi salam. Whether it's Bilha the servant, or it's Zilpah, or it's Leah herself, they all have sons that are no fans of Yusuf alayhi salam all those years. Whatever the drama may have been that's been omitted, we know that the drama existed. The tension existed, right? And one of them is still alive. Now, Rachel has passed. It could be that Leah is still alive, because the Bible describes that she was buried back in the homeland. And it could be that they made it all the way to Egypt. When she died, Jacob said that we should bury her back in our ancestral home. And that's where I want to be buried eventually too. And maybe he took her back from Egypt and got her buried there. But there's no mention of her coming to Egypt. There's only mention of where she got buried. So one theory is Leah was in fact alive. And she's the one being talked about when he says he pulled both his parents into the refuge. Because the person married to your mom is actually your parent. Or has the respect of your parent. You should treat them as the kind of courtesy you owe to your parents. Right? So we'll talk about the implications on the ayah itself, but let's talk about the who. So one possibility is it's Leah. The other possibility is either Zilpah or Bilha, which is interesting because Jewish feminists today are talking about how Zilpah and Bilha, who history doesn't know much about, are not getting the credit they deserve, because Jewish women tend to be forgotten in history, but they are the mothers of the Jewish people. Four of the 12 tribes of Israel come from them. Yet we don't know, because they were servant women, they were handmaidens, we don't know much about them, we don't care anything about them, but we should consider them matriarchs of Jewish society. Now, so what's the Quran's take on this? The Quran's not explicit about who it is. We can pretty confidently say it's not Rachel. But we can say it's either Bilha or Zilpah, which are both servant women, or Leah, the wife. Now let's look at both possibilities and what we could learn from that. If it is the mother of the sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. This is, you know, 6 out of the 10 sons that wronged Yusuf alayhi salam. His father's been suffering, but it's also quite possible, And we don't know. We don't know if Leia is also suffering or not because of the rebellion of her sons, or deep down inside she endorses their emotions. We don't know. So we're not going to throw her under the bus. We don't know, so we don't know. Good enough. Just like we would give benefit of the doubt to somebody who's alive, right? Unless we have some hint that they've done something wrong, or we have evidence to that, we have no reason to suspect her intentions. And if the Bible's saying there was rivalry among them, that's the part I'm not going to take openly. You know, that's the part I'll be skeptical about. Genealogy, I'll take. Character assassination, not so much. You know, even though I described it all to you, I'm not going to say that I'm completely convinced that that was exactly the story, right? But let's just say it is the mother of the sons that abused Yusuf alayhi salam, hurt the father and all of that. What do you think her emotions are as she's walking in to see the son of Rachel up there on the throne? And he's gonna want to give dad a hug, right? Because that's his real family, right? Dad's my real family. Y'all are all together. I'm family with dad. Give this shirt to my father, remember? So she's gonna feel like she's not included, or she doesn't have the place in the heart of Yusuf that Yaqub has. And Yaqub alayhi salam has the presence of heart and the presence of mind to know, in this moment, I cannot let this woman feel deprived or feel neglected or ignored because she's in the position that my mother used to be in. She is the wife of my father. So I will honor her just as I would honor my own mother. So he pulls both of them in and hugs them and makes them feel safe. Even in this moment, he's thinking about the feeling of someone else. And you know, when he saw that dream, the sun, the 11 stars, the sun and the moon, it may also be that at that time, maybe the Binyamin has just been given birth, or the mom is still alive. It's still possible that his mom was still alive. And he doesn't know that that's not going to be the mom. That's going to be out, you know, the one that's going to come back. And when that sajda happens eventually, and this whole dream gets interpreted, he could just say to dad, "That's what the dream meant? I thought it would be my mom." He could do that, right? But he's not going to do that. He treats her as if it's his own mom. And what message does that send to Yusuf's brothers, who hated Yusuf all along because of who his mother is, right? Because he comes from a different... And that's the whole basis of hating Yusuf and Binyamin. And now they see their own mother being honored in this way. Their own mother is being treated like it's his own mother. He holds no grudge. He's so loving towards her, he honored mom and dad just the same. He didn't just hug dad and "Assalamu alaikum to you too." There was none of that. It's a remarkable moment in what Yusuf alayhi salam demonstrates. And the Quran captures it so beautifully by calling both of them his parents, even though it is clear to anyone who understands even a little bit of Jewish history, that's not his biological mom. So that's one possibility. He sent this shockwave message to his brothers and to the stepmom, that you're my mom. You married my dad. You're the life partner for my dad. Your relationship with my dad is blessed. And I will honor you because you are sitting in that position. And the Prophet ﷺ even said, "Al-khalatu fi makanati al-um," or "fi bimanzilati al-um." The maternal aunt is the status of the mom. You know, you have to honor her like you would honor your own mom. What's the other possibility? That Zilpah and Bilhah, who were servant women, handmaidens, one of them is alive and everybody else has passed away. And he comes with one of them and he puts them on the throne. He pulls them in and honors them. And what does that tell you? It tells you how these labels that we have, that she was a handmaiden or she was a servant and all of that, none of that actually played a role in the treatment of people. It's also evidenced by the fact that Zilpah and Bilhah give birth to sons, but they're not any less sons, because even the Quran says all of them are usba. The one that come from Leah and the ones that come from the handmaidens are all just sons. It's not lesser sons or second category sons or second class sons and things like that. It's not like that. So there seems to be some kind of a distinction. It's pretty interesting that the Israelites accept all of these brothers of Yusuf alayhi salam as equal brothers and the patriarchs of the Israelite people. But when it comes to Ibrahim alayhi salam and Hajar, they use the same logic to say he's not really the son. It's pretty funny that if he's not really the son, then four of your tribes are out. Because by that logic, you should be the eight tribes of Israel, bro. You know, so, or cousin. It doesn't work. That doesn't add up. But anyway, the discussion of why Ismail alayhi salam is actually a legitimate and full-fledged son, according not just to the Quran, but the Bible itself, is something I've talked about in Surah Ali Imran. But anyway, so this is kind of an overview I wanted to give you about the mention of both parents and pulling them in and comforting them. Like Yusuf alayhi salam understands, and this is what, you know, the lesson I take away for myself personally and for all of you, one of them is that, you know, Allah has put different people in our life and we're responsible to them. You have a responsibility to your siblings. You have a responsibility to your parents. You have a responsibility to your kids. You have a responsibility to your spouse. You have a responsibility to your coworkers, employees. But before all of that, let's just talk about just in your family. You have responsibility and different rights towards people. And the first right really is to treat people with dignity, with respect, so they don't feel humiliated, right? So he's a living model of that. People who humiliated him, he took the higher road. And he didn't make somebody guilty by association. You're their mom, therefore I hate you. You know, none of that. Or even if he knew of drama between his mother and her, that's all gone. He's not bringing that into the equation. What they do and how they carry themselves is on them. But I will treat people right. And that's a recurring theme in this surah, that Yusuf alayhi salam will treat people not in a naive way, but he will give people, he'll do right by people. He'll do right by parents. He won't make her feel ignored for no reason. She hasn't done anything to him to deserve that. And she deserves that place. She deserves the benefit of the doubt. So he's going to give her that. And he does. Awa ilayhi abawayhi. And now there's the rest of the family. There are, you know, let me tell you the names again. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Gad, Asher, Dan, Naphtali, and their wives and their kids are all watching as both parents have been hugged. And they're like, oh, this is confusing. I thought he'd hug Jacob and give us all a good yelling. I mean, he said there's no harm, but is he really this nice? And what does he say? And they're maybe feeling a little nervous because they used to be abusive to Yaqub alayhi salam, right? Weren't they just, didn't we just learn that they were calling him lost and deluded not too long ago? They were the ones being abusive to him, the extended family, all of them. And now they're standing in the court of the king of Egypt who just, you know, hugged his father that they were just abusing. So they're kind of got a heart in the, you know, the heart in the throat a little bit. And what is he turns to them now. So he's, first things first, honor the parents. Give them a hug. Make them feel safe. And now that they've been dealt with, then he turns to them. وَقَالُوا ادْخُلُوا مِصْرَ إِنْشَاءَ اللَّهُ آمِنِينَ. Enter Egypt. If Allah wills, safely. If Allah wills, we'll deal with separately. Let's just talk about safely. Enter Egypt, aminin, safely. Meaning, it's as if you just got to the airport. This is the first building you've been to. But you can go to Egypt anywhere. Your safety is guaranteed by the prime minister himself. You're safe wherever you go in Egypt. You can go freely wherever you like. You are not going to be put in a well. Welcome to Egypt. Here's a place where you shall be safe. And the one promising safety is the one that they would be scared of. He's the one giving them safety, so they have nothing. And he's the one who ensures the safety of the entire country. So he's offering them safety, or he's saying peacefully. Also, aminin can also mean that you carry no grudges and you come here safe and you don't have to worry about any previous thing that will be held against you. You're completely settled and at peace now. And this is how, perhaps it also means, come into Egypt, aminin, peacefully, meaning if you have drama, leave it behind. Leave it in Canaan, let's start over. Aminin. So what does insha'Allah here mean? Insha'Allah means, this is the first lesson here with insha'Allah. Insha'Allah, let's talk about how we use insha'Allah. We use insha'Allah, the wrong way we use it is when we're not really sure about what we're going to do, like, hey, so I'll see you at 7 o'clock like you promised, right? You're like, inshallah, which means I'm not sure. Or don't hold it against me. And if I'm late, we'll just blame Allah, right? So that's not how you're supposed to use inshallah. Inshallah is a statement about your hope in the future. That's in Muslim culture, not in the sacred text. In our culture, it's become a phrase we use when we are hopeful about accomplishing something in the future. You know, I'm going to graduate, inshallah. I'm going to go through, you know, I'm going to pass this exam, inshallah, et cetera, et cetera. So the word inshallah has become a word for optimism placed with Allah. Originally, inshallah was actually not that. Inshallah was, I have hopes of accomplishing this. But that I know that will only happen if Allah wills it to. Which is different from prayer. This is why the Prophet ﷺ advised us against using inshallah when we pray. You don't say, you know, and we say this because we associate inshallah with optimism, right? So we innocently say sometimes, may Allah give you Jannah inshallah. And you're like, yes, inshallah. The problem with that is, may Allah give you Jannah if He wants to. Because inshallah means if Allah wills. You're like, yes, if He wants. Because if He doesn't, then we're not supposed to say that. This is why we don't say inshallah with prayers. So what's inshallah doing here? If Allah wills. Enter Egypt if Allah wills safely. Yusuf alayhi salam knows more than anyone that even if you have Allah's promise that Allah has chosen you and He will teach you all kinds of speech and complete His favor upon you. Remember all of that? كَذَلِكَ يَجْتَبِيكَ رَبُّكَ وَيُعَلِّمُكَ مِنْ تَأْوِيلِ الْحَدِيثِ وَيُتِمُّ نِعْمَتَهُ عَلَيْكَ كَمَا أَتَمَّهَا عَلَى أَبَوَيْكَ إِبْرَاهِيمَ وَإِسْحَاقَ. All of that, مِنْ قَبْلِ إِبْرَاهِيمَ وَإِسْحَاقَ. All of those promises that Allah, that Yaqub told him that Allah has planned for him, but was not told to him is all the trials in between before you get to that. Right? I mean, it happened eventually. But you don't know, you don't even have a guarantee of the next moment. I, as the ruler of Egypt, am telling you, you are safe wherever you go. But even I, the ruler of Egypt, cannot override the ruler of all rulers, Ahkamul Hakimin. If he wants, your safety will end in the first step outside. I know I was in the safety of my home one day, and in the depths of a well in another. I know I was in a prison rotting forever one day and now running Egypt the next day. When, if Allah wills something to happen, what we think will happen can completely transform. And I'm a living example of that. So I'm never going to say anything about the future without adding what? Inshallah. That's only if Allah wills. I recognize Allah's decree here. And this is also an interesting echo with what Yaqub alayhi salam said to his sons. You know, if Allah wills, you know, and I want you to go to Egypt from, you know, enter Egypt from different doors, and I can't benefit you against Allah's will in any way. In other words, yes, I'm hoping you stay safe, but inshallah, that's only if Allah wills it to be. So just take this road, and inshallah, if Allah wills, it will be like that. The other meaning of inshallahu aminin can also be when you give an instruction to somebody and you add Allah's name to that instruction, it's as if you're endorsing it, like, you know, come over inshallah. You know, you say, come over inshallah. Or let's talk inshallah. You know what you've done? You've expressed a prayer. Inshallah can be looked at in a sense that way as a prayer or as a declaration that you have, I've brought Allah into this conversation because with Allah's witness, you're safe. Really, with Allah's witness that you're safe. So, udkhulu Misra, insha'Allahu aminin, is to the rest of the family. You can settle in Egypt wherever you are safely. This is the shocking moment. These are the first things that these, you know, brothers and their children together and their wives who have been talking so much against Binyamin and Yusuf and their father for so many years. And all of those years is now known. Everything they did is known. And they're standing in front of the person they wronged for so many years. And the first thing they see him do is hug both his parents and to treat his non-biological mom as if she is the mom. And then turn to all of them and tell them you're safe. This place, I will guarantee your safety. I'll make sure that you're safe. وَدْخُلُوا مِصْرَى إِنْشَاءَ اللَّهُ آمِنِينَ. It's a remarkable moment. And the thing that I wanted to, before I let you guys go, highlight is how the Quran actually, in this way, addresses complex family situations. You've got a man with multiple wives, or you've got multiple children from multiple marriages, right? And some parents alive and some not alive. And so you've got half mom, or, you know, adopting mom, or not biological mom at all. And you've got all these kinds of, you know, half connections. And so you've got half brothers, or you've got half sisters, and you've got, you know, rivalries that may have come down from a different generation. And in all of that, Allah Azza wa Jalla describes that when that tension happens, that tension actually comes from shaitan. And it's also really interesting that the Quran recognizes these complex family dynamics as a part of life. That's just going to happen. You know, we have this picture in our head of a certain view of what a family should look like, right? But since ancient times, families were always complicated, and they're always going to be complicated. If any of you and your extended family is completely normal, let me know. I'd be really happy to know about this exception on planet Earth, because ain't nobody's family normal. Everybody's got some drama in their family, some complexity in their family. And everybody who has a complexity in their family wonders, why is our family so messed up? Why are we so weird? Why do we have a Reuben in our family? Why do we have a, you know, why do we have a Leah and Rachel situation in our family? Why do we have this? Why do we have that? Well, that's always been there, because shaitan's always been there. It's also teaching us that shaitan is an enemy. Yes, he's an enemy to Islam, and he wants to eradicate Islam from the face of the earth and all of that. One of the ways to eradicate Islam is to eradicate Muslims from within. And what better way to destroy Muslims from within is than to destroy their families, to get them to hate each other? How is this ummah going to be united when people that share the same last name with you can't be united? People that live under a roof can't be united, and you're talking about the ummah being united? So you destroy the brick, their building's never going to be built, right? That's such an easy game, such an easy strategy, and it works. So it's so much easier for us to be kind and understanding and empathetic to strangers that can cry about their woes. And the only people we cannot be empathetic towards or patient to hear what they have to say or try to understand their point of view or be forgiving is our own. Our own we can't forgive. Everybody else, hey, man, is going through a lot. I understand. Poor guy. This is why people are so eager to give charity to strangers and to watch a video and feel bad, and you should. But when your own uncle will ask, you're not going to give. That uncle? No, remember last Eid? Not him. That's not, please. I know everything about him. There's no way I'm helping him, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Whether it's siblings or cousins or uncles or sometimes parents, whatever it may be, this is why وَأُولُوا الْأَرْحَامِ بَعْضُهُمْ أَوْلَى بِبَعْضٍ فِي كِتَابِ اللَّهِ. People of the womb, the relationships of the womb, the people that are tied to you through the womb, they get priority over other people in Allah's book. Take care of those relationships first. وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ الَّذِي تَسَاءَلُونَ بِهِ وَالْأَرْحَامِ. Be mindful of Allah, whose name you use to ask each other for stuff, and be mindful of the wombs, meaning all blood relations and all relations that extend from blood. Be mindful of them. Be careful about them. And it's so beautiful that, you know, children are being taught to be respectful to their parents, even if one of the parents isn't your biological parent. That's what children are being taught through the example of awa ilayhi abawayhi. Be respectful, even if it's not your biological father. Be respectful, even if she's not your biological mother. They still deserve respect. They're still, Allah placed them in the same place. Awa ilayhi abawayhi. It also tells you that the role of a son or a daughter in older age is to provide refuge, is to provide comfort. Because as we get older, we get weaker. And we need comfort, just like we were babies and we needed comfort in the arms of our mothers and the protection of our fathers. A time comes where they need our protection. They need to feel safe around us. They're getting old. Their back hurts when they sit down. Their knees hurt when they go up the stairs. They have to go from one doctor's appointment to another appointment. They can't stand up as long as they used to be able to. Their eyesight doesn't work. They can't remember things the way they used to. Their skin's getting wrinklier and wrinklier. They can't drive on their own. And as they become like that, yeah, they get crankier. They get harder to deal with. They test your patients more. They have more wisecracks now. They've been working on them for decades. So they test your patients more now than they ever did before. But you know what? You're supposed to be like, you and I are supposed to be like Yusuf alayhi salam, awa ilayhi abawayhi. He pulled his parents into his refuge. Even the parent that he had no biological connection to, and arguably, possibly, even had a grudge to hold because she was competitive with his mom. Or her kids are the ones that made his life hell and she did nothing about it. You can make all those arguments. Again, we're going to give her benefit of the doubt. But inside family, giving benefit of the doubt is hard, right? That's difficult. But he does it. He does it. It's also interesting in the Quran earlier on, we find Yusuf alayhi salam alone. We find him lonely. We don't find him turning to his, like Rasul sallallahu alayhi salam, when he got overwhelmed, he turned to his wife, right? That's what happened at Hudaybiyah. Yaqub alayhi salam is married, so when he's being overwhelmed in grief, you should find the presence of mom. Quran misses that. Now, what possible reason could there be? You could look at it two ways. You could say, well, she didn't really care. So she was like the wife of Lut or the wife of Nuh, etc. That's one way you can possibly look at it. I prefer not to. Another way you can look at it is she felt helpless. Her sons are grown. They're out of her hands. And let's just say she was an extremely loving wife to Yaqub alayhi salam. This will be my last thought for you. Let's just say she's an extremely supportive wife, whether it's Leah or Zilpah or Bilhah, whichever one. And she's caring for him. She's concerned about him, even if she's all of those things. Sometimes a person is going through grief and they're going through something. They're going through a sadness. And it doesn't matter how much you love them, you can't take that sadness away. Just like you cannot actually make someone happy. You cannot get rid of somebody else's sadness. You're not responsible to make someone else okay. His grief with Yusuf is his grief with Yusuf. You don't get to say as his wife, I'm here, I love you, why are you still upset? Yes, I love you too. That's amazing and thank you, but I'm still devastated about my baby. That still hurts me. Well, why does it hurt you? You have so many other things you should be happy about. No, that's, you have me. Yes, I have you, but that's still there. And even if someone doesn't get frustrated with you, because why are you sad? It may also be that they feel helpless. Like, I wish I could help. I wish I could get rid of that sadness for you. Because when you feel hurt, I feel hurt. But there's also an acceptance that some aspects of our grief are ours alone to carry. Nobody else can carry them for us. Some parts of those sadnesses cannot be shared with anybody. They're just taken to Allah. إِنَّمَا أَشْكُوا بَثِّي وَحُزْنِي إِلَى اللَّهِ. It could be that that's one of the ways to look at that ayah. That there are some aspects of grief that no matter what human support you have, it can maybe mitigate it a little bit, but it can't get rid of it. It can't be addressed that way. And maybe that's the role. That's why she's not been mentioned. Perhaps Allah is teaching us something about that. That sometimes you can be as supporting and as loving and as present as you can, but the situation still can't be helped because it's beyond your control. Accepting that we are not in complete control of every situation and every emotion that the people we love feel, that acceptance is a really big part of moving on in life and to have meaningful relationships in life and to understand Allah, who controls the movement of every leaf, controls the beat of every heart. Now, we can't change that. We can't make someone love something, make someone hate something. We can't make someone happy. Now, one thing we are capable of, Allah has made us capable of, we can give someone grief. That He's given us. You know, we can hurt someone with our words. We can do right by someone. We can be a source of comfort for them. We can be kind towards them. Maybe we can bring them joy with our words. But understand that at the end of the day, we cannot control how someone else is going to feel. And we cannot alter how someone else is going to feel. That's going to have to be sometimes between them and Allah. They have to find their way, you know? And that they have to find that relief from Allah Azza wa Jal. That even Yaqub alayhi salam had to find that relief with Allah Azza wa Jal. You know, he being married, because, you know, that's what surprised both me and Suhaib. At the end of all this story, he pulled both his parents in. Wait, he was married all this time? But he was so alone. Look at all these pages. Sabrun Jameen, Wallahu Musta'an. All those, what happened to all those pages? He was married that whole time? Where was the missus? Well, that's my take on the missus. You know, I'd rather not give her benefit of the doubt. The Quran didn't cast a doubt on her goodness. The Quran is completely silent about her, which means we should either be silent or think good. Right? That's my take on it. We should either be silent because no hint has been given, or we should think good of her. So that's my two cents on what I've come to understand about ayah number 99 of this surah. May Allah Azza wa Jalla give us all healing through Allah's words and ease our situations and give our hearts comfort in knowing that Allah put His most beloved slaves through trials like these. And inshallah, we have reached ayah 100. 100 and 101 are technically the end of the story, not the surah, but the end of the story. And I think 100 is going to take me a couple of days to finish. So I must make my epic exit as I leave you. Barakallahu li wa lakum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.